Welcome back. Before we jump in, how'd the homework go?
I control like in the off I on and how the work finding out.
Okay. In terms of what?
Just like with gift switches,
okay. I don't know. So, any specific things you'd like to see covered? Not sure if there's all that much more to say, but let's see. Lay out sort of blank slide. So, topology request, look at. Anybody care? 4.3. I'll post solutions to those. And I want to skip one that's a little bit more involved in terms of length without any additional theory, just to move on to the lecture for today. But let's do, I don't know, did the buck before, maybe buck boost? Oh, I lost my screen. That's weird. Okay, so I've got my buck boost here. BGL. The output voltage, find IL in this direction. So I've already implemented it with two single pole, single throw switches. I'll call them A and B. And then what I need to know is for each of these single pole, single throw switches, what voltages must it block when off? What currents must it conduct when on? Right. I had some questions in after hours about voltages when it's on and currents when it's off. Those should be zero, otherwise the thing's not a good switch, right? Regardless, if it's got some voltage across it when it's on, that's anything more than some very small IL times R on or VD kind of thing, then it's not a good switch. So we're really just concerned with its ability to block large voltages, what polarity do those have to be, and conduct large currents. So really the process of figuring out what a switch can be is making sure that whatever we pick is going to be able to do the job. So if I say, okay, this switch A has to conduct currents in both directions, I'm going to put a diode there, it's not going to work like I need it to work. So this process is saying, okay, for my operation of this converter, what do I need out of the switch to make sure that it'll work? So in this case, we've moved from a single pole dual throw switch to two single pole, single throw switches. We know they're going to operate alternately, right? So when A is on, B is off. B is on, A is off. So looking at switch A and switch B, for each of these, I'll see what's happening in each of the subintervals. So let's call subinterval 1, A is on, B is off. So with A on, I care about what the current flowing through it is. So subinterval 1, the current flowing through switch A, in this case, is just IL. With B off, I care about what the voltage across it is. Right. With IL, this is open. I have IL flowing in this loop. B off, I care about the voltage on it. See, I've got to define my polarities here. I'm going to define IA and VA for this switch. And let's do VB, IB for this guy. Okay. So then my voltage on switch B when it's off, we'll go around the loop, input voltage, output voltage. It's going to be VG minus V. Okay. And my subinterval 2 is going to be A off, B on. I open A, I close B. Let's see, let me do this in a different color and match up. So this is going to be where I figure out what the off state voltage of switch A is and the on state current of switch B is. Okay, so with A off and B on, the voltage VA is VG minus V. Right? V is shorted through to that switch node. This will be the current flowing through switch B, based on the way I've defined IB, the off-state current is negative IL. Okay. So now I've got definitions for these things. What I don't know is what's the polarity of IL? This positive, negative, or could it potentially be both as I change the duty cycle and conversion ratio around? Similarly for V, if I haven't analyzed yet, I don't know what the polarity of V is, what the value is. Could this term be both greater than or less than zero, or is this always positive, always negative? Right? So to solve all of that, I need to run volt second balance, tap charge balance, and solve my converter as normal to get my expressions for what is V and what is IL. Do we care to go through that? So in this case, IL and the buck boost is going to be V over RD prime still. Is that right? V over Okay. So then I can plug in here. So IL is minus V over RD prime, which is equal to, I need to plug in for V because I still don't know the polarity of it necessarily, VG times minus D over D prime. It should be VG times D over RD prime squared. Something's messed up. VG times D over D prime over R times D prime. Is that right? Which A. Well, I may have some algebra here, but at least algebra error here. But that's always going to be greater than zero, which is the right thing. VG, D, D prime, R, all these things are positive always. So this expression is always going to be positive. Okay. V off here is VG minus V. I plug in for V, a bad choice of converters to work with. VG minus V, which is minus D over D prime VG, is equal to VG times 1 plus D over D prime. And that's always greater than zero. Because all of these things are positive. Right? So now my current's greater than zero, my voltage is greater than zero. This is a single quadrant switch, same polarity. That thing is a transistor. Okay. Down here, same process, but it's the same two expressions. So I'm just gonna skip it. Minus IL is going to be always less than zero. VG minus V is always greater than zero. That's another single quadrant switch, but opposite polarity. Switch B is a diode. And sketch it with those things implemented. Okay. Any questions? Does that help? I might have made an algebra error there. It looks a little strange to me. So be wary of it, but that's the process. Okay. No other questions? Then we'll move on. Last week we were talking about this example application, 48 volt bus in an electric vehicle. What we wanted to do with that is design a converter that could be used in this system. Our specs for the system was we wanted to go from 12 volts to 48 volts, 48 watts output, minimize the ripple. We solved in the ideal case of how this is going to operate. We'll have a duty cycle of 3/4 and solved our output voltage ripple to make sure that our output capacitance is large enough to achieve the spec. Use this baseline design we just pulled from a web designer. Eventually we'll be able to do this ourselves, but we needed a starting point. So I used that to kick us off. So we're switching at 200 kilohertz. It gave us our passives, verified that it designed something that'll meet our ripple spec. And then we went through and looked at the devices it chose and found from the data sheet what these parasitic parameters were that we need for our loss model. Voltage and resistance of the diode, resistance of the MOSFETs, two of them in parallel, and then DC resistance of the inductor. And sketched out what we expect to see for waveforms of this converter. Note here, as I was looking back, one thing I didn't bother to do is draw the duty cycle correctly. I just put an arbitrary line somewhere in the middle. What we solved is it should be 75%, so this should be 75% of the period if I was being a little more accurate with my drawing, but generally the behavior is going to look like this. Okay, have transistor conducting in the first interval, some kind of trapezoidal current, diode in the second interval. Both of these add up to the inductor current. One's conducting it, then the other. and the switch node going back and forth between 0 and V. Okay. So I want to predict the performance of this. So without rehashing it in lecture, I go through, derive my equivalent circuit model for the boost, very similar to the buck boost that we did before, just non-inverting and no D transformer on the input. Solve it for expressions for my output voltage and my conversion ratio. And then I can go through and from these expressions, plug in all those loss parameters I have and solve them for things like what the actual duty cycle is. So plugging in D is 0.756 versus D ideal 0.75. Is that 7 too? So the duty cycle has to be a little bit greater than my ideal case. Think of this, my ideal case, 0.75 gives me the 48 volts output. When I start adding in losses, my output voltage is going to drop slightly, be lower than what it would have been in the ideal case. And I have to boost up that duty cycle a little bit to compensate for those losses. Okay. Why we get this expression here where my conversion ratio, M is M ideal times the efficiency. So I solve for the duty cycle, plug in and figure out what my efficiency is that I'm predicting. This will tell me my efficiency is 97.6%, which is a pretty good number for this application. I'd be happy with that, most likely for this simple topology. Okay. So I want to figure out if I've made any mistakes, if there's anything I'm missing. So I'm going to take this converter and I'm going to simulate it. I used LTSpice here, plugged in kind of equivalent models of everything. Main converter's up here. This stuff, again, is just kind of my control loop. Modeling what's going on and what they've designed for me. And this is my PWM modulator and gate driver. Something that translates a reference voltage into a duty cycle controlled PWM waveform to drive these FETs high enough voltage to get them into this lower on resistance, drive them at 10 volts, make sure the R on gets down to that 4 milliohms. Okay. Again, have these two FETs in parallel, and then models of my diode and my inductor. This has RL inside of it. This has R on. This has VD and RD and all the characteristics of the diode. Okay, so I plug it in, I simulate, same passive value, same switching frequency, and I get efficiency of 93.9. Okay. I'm predicting 97.6. I get 93.9. If we're talking grades on homeworks, maybe 97.6, 93.9, not much difference. Both pretty darn good. But when we're talking efficiencies, okay, 1 minus the efficiency is the percent of your power going to loss. Right? 2.4% predicted. 6.1% here, it's almost triple the amount of loss that I expected. Way more power loss than what I'm predicting from my model. Power loss is approximately 3x expected. This thing is much worse than I hoped it would be. Okay, what's going on? So on the next slide, I'm going to look at waveforms and try to see if there's anything inconsistent with my analysis. I'm going to look at, again, inductor current, IL, I'm going to look at this switch node voltage, look at the diode current, ID, and then I'm going to look at the MOSFET current, which is the sum of IT1 and IT2. since I have these two things directly in parallel, I'm just going to sum up the current and plot it, treat it as kind of one device with these two in parallel. Okay. So I plot that and I get this. This is my diode current, my MOSFET current. I called it I1 earlier on our expected waveforms. Thing down here is my inductor current, I sub L, and my switch node voltage is here. So IL looks kind of as expected. It's this triangular wave. We had predicted last class that it should be 4 amps DC and 1 amp ripple. And I get somewhere around 4 amps and then plus or minus 1 amp of ripple. More or less right. The 4 amps came from our ideal analysis. We didn't consider losses. The current has to be a little bit greater when you have losses to supply that extra loss and still get the output power there. So that looks about right. Switch node voltage pulses between 0 and 48 volts. The output voltage looks about right. Okay, my diode current and transistor current really just split this inductor current. I've got my axes go from 3 to 5 here. They go from 0 to 10 on that one. So it's this same current. In this interval, it's going through the transistor. In this interval, it's going through the diode. The transistor kind of overlaps during these switching times, but the diode current does this kind of a thing. Those look more or less like expected. Does anything look off about this? We have this giant spike going on at this switching action. Okay. Most of it looks similar, but then there's this huge thing that's actually going off screen. So that is the question, what's going on here? So to look at it, I'm gonna zoom in on that on my x-axis here. So here it was, I guess I've deleted my labels, here to here was one switching period. I'm going to zoom in just kind of on this time and look at these waveforms again. Here to here is some few nanoseconds. Looking at again the transistor current, diode current, switch node voltage, and then my gate to source voltage on the MOSFET. So around this time is when VGS greater than threshold, somewhere up 10 volts, and it begins to turn on the device. Then there's some pretty significant delay here before the device actually turns on. The dynamics of the gate take some time. Then when it does actually start to turn on, what I see is almost a equal and opposite ramp up of current between the transistor and the diode, right? So the transistor takes all this positive current, the diode takes all of this negative current. Negative current can't be right, right? This is a diode. Diodes can't have negative current. That's their only job. In fact, that's a steady state characteristic. The diodes can't take DC negative current, but in a transient situation, they can have negative current. The spike up to 500 amps down to minus 500 amps. It's a massive spike. Part of that's idealized simulation where there's no impedance in certain loops. In reality, it might not be this big, but this thing would show up in a real circuit and it'd be tens, hundreds of amps. For a very brief time, and I lost my time axis here, but this should be something like, let's say 100 nanoseconds. Estimate, but something much smaller than my period of 5 microseconds. Okay. It's all happening very quickly, small part of the waveform, but what's going on? Okay. It looks like I have my diode, my transistor, and then my output voltage V. This big positive current through the transistor, negative current through the diode. It looks like there is a big spike of current that does this. maybe completes through the cap, maybe not, but seems to be coming through both of these devices in equal part. Okay. When it's happening, there's a little bit of change in the switch node voltage, the voltage blocked by this MOSFET, but almost none. It's almost still locked at the output voltage with all of this current flowing through it. That's going to be bad, right? Now I have 500 amps at 40 volts, and multiply those two, I get 8 kilowatts, 5, 4, 2 kilowatts. Math, who needs it? So to understand this effect, what I'm going to have to do is we're going to jump into kind of what's going on at the semiconductor level in this diode and examine what's happening here. But this is a real thing, what's going to be called reverse recovery. Of the diode results in a lot of power loss. Okay. All right, so to talk about this, I'm going to begin talking about semiconductor physics a little bit in diodes. Power diodes may look a little bit different than what you've seen before, normally diode PN junction. Diodes used for high voltage, high power applications tend to have this graded doping profile, where instead of just PN, FP, then N minus, then N, where N minus means very lightly doped with electrons. Okay. So this one is pretty heavily doped with holes to be P-type. This is heavily doped. Electrons, this is lightly doped with electrons. Okay. Get into exactly why that is over the slide and the next slide. But what do I want out of this thing? I'm designing it as a power diode. I'd like it to be low loss, be a good conductor with low resistance, low forward voltage. I'd like it to be able to block a high voltage, whatever I need in my converter. So in this case, the output voltage, 48 volts. So I'm going to look at those two things. What is kind of the mechanism for conduction loss in this? What is the voltage blocking capability of this section of semiconductor as it's designed? I'm going to kind of just jump right into a little bit of detail on the mathematics of semiconductor physics. Not really an emphasis of this course, but I want you to understand where these things come from. It's more important that you take away an understanding of what's going on in the diode than that you be able to apply Poisson's equation or anything that we cover real quickly. Okay. But I'm going to use them to show you where this stuff comes from. So I want to first look at the resistivity of this material, of any semiconductor material. Is going to have to do with conduction losses in a general chunk of semiconductor. So I'm just going to break off this P-type region, and I'm going to look at a segment of it. So this is my P region, and I want to flow some current through that, some current I. I want to know what kind of resistance I'm going to see as I try to push current laterally through this chunk of P material. So that resistance of this P material is going to look like some rho, whatever its resistivity is, times the geometry of the problem. We'll call it L over A, where L is this distance. L sub x, and then A is the area of this space. Right. This true regardless of whether it's semiconductor or any other material. Resistance is the resistivity of the material. It gets bigger as I conduct through a longer length. It gets smaller as I conduct through a bigger area, effectively just putting more of it in parallel versus putting more of it in series. right? Now for semiconductors specifically, this resistivity has to do with how heavily doped the material is. If I put more free carriers in there, it's going to be more conductive. So if I plug in for this resistivity, it looks like 1 over UNNQ plus mu P times P times Q times this LX over A, where mu is the permittivity of the material, permittivity of N-type material or P-type material. Generally, here, this term is going to dominate, the term that has to do with my holes over the term that has to do with my electrons. But this is permittivity. This is a carrier concentration. And Q is unit charge. Okay. So permittivity of N-type material times the number of free electrons times unit charge plus permittivity of P-type material, the number of free holes times unit charge. Okay. So from this equation, what are my conclusions? If I want low resistance, should be low amounts of conduction loss. What I want to do is I want to design this thing with very high doping density. And short length and large A. Okay, so my permittivity is my unit charge. Those are, you know, fixed numbers. Those are fixed values. Those are constants. But my carrier concentration, I can dope more heavily to get a larger number of carriers, and I can control the geometry of it. So what I want is a whole lot of doping, short length, large area. Okay, I put in this N minus thing, which is very lightly doped and pretty darn long. So that's going to be counterintuitive to everything I want to do here. Hopefully there's a good reason why I did that. Otherwise, it seems like a pretty bad idea. So get into why I need that. What I'm going to look at is separating this diode into the off state and the on state. I'm going to first look at what happens when I reverse bias this thing. Okay. So my reverse bias, I'm applying a negative voltage, shuts the diode off, puts it into this reverse bias operating mode. Hopefully you remember from old semiconductor physics class what happens when you reverse bias a diode. In order to block that field, what I'm going to get is this depletion region across the PN junction that expands out, where in that depletion region, the semiconductors on both sides are completely devoid of any free carriers. All of my free carriers get moved out and kind of filled up around the edges of this depletion region. I'll have my free electrons out here, my free holes getting pushed out over here. In the middle, what I'll have is bound charges that are left uncovered as I remove my free carriers. These are free carriers that can conduct current. These are bound charges that cannot move. Which are of the opposite type as whatever is doped in the material. Okay. So P-type material inherently has no net charge, just has free carriers that are positive. The whole thing is not net positive, net neutral. As I remove all those free carriers out, what I'm left with is bound negative charge. Okay. So this is a big region that is completely devoid of any carriers. Looks like just a big chunk of dielectric. There's no carriers. It cannot conduct current through here. Real current, non-displacement current. Okay. So this thing tends to look like just a big capacitor where everything in here is like a dielectric, an isolator, because there's no free carriers. And then I have a bunch of charges lined up on the end. My free charges like charge on the plates of the capacitor. This section really looks like some big parallel plate capacitor. Where my capacitance is some function of the length of my depletion region. How wide this depletion region is going to depend, is going to determine the distance between the plates on this capacitor, and that's going to change the capacitance. So that's going to be important momentarily. An off-state diode is going to look kind of like a capacitor. The other thing that's important for understanding the design of this diode is how does this need to be designed to ensure that I can block a given voltage with it? If I want to make this 100-volt diode to put in my converter, I want to guarantee that it can block 100 volts. How does that relate to physical dimensions, doping densities of this? Okay. So the way to solve that is Poisson's equation. And again, I'm going to hop through this a bit. Poisson's equation is grad squared C is equal to rho F over epsilon. This is my Laplace operator, which means I'm doing a second derivative in multiple dimensions. C is electric potential. This is charge density. Is permeability. Again, I'm not going to expect you to be able to apply Poisson's equation. That's not a focus of this class. But what I want to do is I want to use that to get to a result. So I'm going to apply this. This is kind of how the problem is formulated in three dimensions. So I'm just going to look at a one-dimensional problem, which is as I move through this semiconductor from left to right, what is the electric field in it? Okay, so I want to know what the electric field inside this material is as I go along an axis X, which is this axis. And I'm assuming that within that cross-sectional area, everything's uniform. The whole thing's uniform all the way across. I don't need to do two or three dimensions. I can just look at one dimension. Okay. So I'm going to have, if I go across this, I'll go from my P to my N minus to my N material. And somewhere in there, I'm going to have the edges of my depletion region. So when I take Poisson's equation, three dimensions, map it into one dimension, it becomes partial squared of V with respect to X is equal to charge density over permeability. That charge density is going to look like my unit charge times N or P. Whatever the number of my free carriers is per unit length in this case, divided by still the permeability of the material. Electric field is the derivative of voltage. So second derivative of voltage is the derivative of electric field, or E is partial v, partial x is equal to the integral with respect to x of this qn over epsilon. Where this is my net charge in an area. Okay. That's where this all comes from. End result is that as I go through this material out here, where I have my free carriers, I'm going to have no electric field. I have free carriers, and it still looks like a decent conductor. Then when I hit the depletion region, I'm going to begin integrating up this constant charge density divided by permeability. And what I'm going to get is an electric field that ramps up. It's going to ramp up very quickly in heavily doped areas because this electric field is the integral of something that depends on the carrier density. So when this is high, it's going to integrate up very quickly. So when I get over here, instead of negative charges, I'm integrating positive charges. And it's going to integrate down much more slowly because I have a lower doping density. Slope here should be qn over epsilon. The slope here should be qp over epsilon. Okay. So now, finally get into talking about why do I have this big n minus region? Okay. So for doped silicon, the parameter of it, the critical electric field, which is the maximum electric field which can be sustained in that material before it breaks down, okay, or there's an electrical breakdown and it begins conducting, right? So that had better be somewhere up here, greater than the maximum electric field that I'm asking this device to sustain when I'm blocking voltage. Otherwise, it's going to break down and not be able to block that voltage. Okay. So with what I drew here, okay, my voltage is going to be the integral of the electric field. Let's say proportional to the integral of the electric field. So the total voltage I can block is kind of this area times some constant. If I had doped this N minus region more heavily, then to block that same voltage, I would have to go much higher because my slope is going to be steeper due to the higher doping density in this region. Now my electric field in the material has surpassed the critical electric field and it breaks down. Okay. So the reason we have to have this large, lightly doped region, what we're trying to do is pull the electric field further out into this N minus material so I can sustain a large voltage without having a high critical field. Okay. This is where it comes from. You may remember the width of the depletion region is proportional to 1 over carrier density, carrier concentration. So if I have very heavily doped material, my depletion region only extends a little bit into that. If I have very lightly doped material, my depletion region extends very far into that. Okay. So, conclusions, large, lightly doped, and minus region used to obtain voltage blocking capability. Okay. Bunch of stuff, semiconductor physics. These are the takeaways I want you to get from this. There's a reason I need this, and it's to be able to block the voltage I want. For low resistance, I'd really like to get rid of this thing and just highly dope everything. If I do that, I can hardly block any voltage, because as soon as I try to reverse bias it, critical electric field is going to spike right up instead of being extended out into the region. Okay. Two, when it's off, it's going to look like this diode, because I have this big depletion region, big essentially insulator with charges on either side. It's going to look like a essentially diode capacitor. Okay. So this implies there's some kind of trade-off in the design of this, right? So I have to compromise on voltage blocking capability to get something that's a really good conductor, or vice versa. Okay. That's generally true of semiconductor elements. Diodes in particular have kind of a way around this, and that has to do with what happens in a diode when it's forward biased. So when I forward bias a diode, what happens? Well, my depletion region narrows, and so it's just this small junction potential. And then what I end up getting is, to sustain external current, I have to have injection of carriers across this barrier. So this barrier voltage is what's going to cause my forward voltage, VD. And then the resistivity of all the material is what's going to cause my RD. Okay. So this is that junction potential. It's just going to be a fixed voltage. And everything out here contributes to resistance. Diode is a minority carrier device. Means that when it's conducting current, it's really holes in my n-type region and electrons in my p-type region that are sustaining the current. When I begin to forward bias it, these holes from the p-type region jump across this barrier and begin sustaining the current over here in the n-type region. Okay. Minority carrier devices are diodes, BJT, IGBT. SCRs, thyristors, other things. Okay. So there is something really cool that I get out of this. And it's known as conductivity modulation. This big N minus region would potentially kill me and create a very large resistance. The resistivity of just this N minus region is very high. It would cause my conduction losses to be too high. But because of this minority carrier injection, because my resistance depends on all free carriers, both my electrons and my holes, when this thing is forward biased, I actually inject in a bunch more free minority carriers, and those drop the resistance. Okay. Conductivity modulation is minority carriers injected, and I have more carriers the higher the current is. So I get this really nice relationship where the higher the current is, the worse my conduction losses would be, but the more carriers get injected and my effective resistance gets lower. So this thing gets more and more conductive the more current I try to push through it, which is good. It results in diodes losses being dominated by this junction potential, which is just a function of the material and the doping density here. How much you can do about it doesn't have to do with area or geometry. And having relatively little resistance, much more losses from that potential than from the resistance. Okay. Conductivity modulation is a great thing. What makes these good conductors at high voltage? It's until very recently the only reason we had decent high voltage devices above 600 to 1,000 volts, because of using this conductivity modulation. Okay. The bad thing is I have a stored minority charge must be removed to turn the device off. So, on time, we'll get into this next time, but what it means is this thing's been conducting a high current, injected a bunch of minority carriers into this region, which is great because it makes it very conductive and gets my conduction losses down. But now if I want to shut it off, before this thing can become reverse bias, I have to pull all of these charges back out. Those were the charges that were sustaining my current, the charge moving in this direction. To get them out, I'm going to have to pull them back in that direction, which is going to be requiring, to do it quickly, big negative current going through this thing to pull all those stored minority charges back out and get the diode to shut off. This is fundamentally where reverse recovery comes from. We'll look at the waveforms and the analysis of them next time. Have a good weekend.